The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So last week I started a series on the Eightfold Path, and this week I'd like to talk about right intention, which is the second factor of the Eightfold Path. And just as a reminder, the factors of the Eightfold Path are right view or wise view, wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. And over the coming weeks, I'll be talking about each of these factors of the path. And this week, in talking about intention, it blends very well with the theme that we're working with the householder retreat this week, which is clear comprehension. And the aspects of clear comprehension that we've been focusing on are purpose, the direction of our lives, and whether the purpose of our actions is in line with our aspirations, our goals, our deepest wishes and our priorities. And so this notion of right intention fits in with that. So our intentions, the reasons why we do things, often come to be out of some underlying views that we hold or beliefs that we hold. So the views that we have, the views that we work with, the beliefs that we operate with, cause us to act in certain ways. So the intention that we have in terms of taking action aligns itself with our purpose, our aims, our ideals, and the goals that are related to our views. We often live with views that are not so clear to us, and views that are given to us by our culture. So, for instance, that happiness is found by accumulating wealth and status is a view that many of us in this culture have been indoctrinated with. And that results in intentions to accumulate wealth and to try to find ourselves in positions of power or status. So, in understanding this connection between view and intention, the Buddha first pointed to wise view as a way to orient ourselves and then to try to find intentions that come in line with those views. So last week I talked about the wise view of the Eightfold Path being basically two aspects I talked about last week. The aspect of understanding karma, understanding that the choices that we make influence our experience, and that when we choose skillfully, when our choices are motivated out of skillful actions, out of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, it tends to lead us towards happiness. And when our actions are motivated out of greed, aversion, and delusion, it tends to lead us towards suffering. So this is the kind of fundamental understanding of the law of karma, that our choices and our motivations influence what happens to us. There's a link between what we choose to do and what happens to us. What goes around comes around, some say. The second aspect of wise view is understanding the Four Noble Truths, understanding the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, and the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering, and understanding that there are actions associated with these truths, that we're enjoined to understand suffering, let go of the cause of suffering, let go of the craving that is said to be the cause of suffering, to realize for ourselves the release from suffering, and to cultivate the path that leads to the ending of suffering, the Eightfold Path. So the view expressed in Wise View is kind of opposed to the standard view of our culture, that of accumulating things in order to be happy. What the Buddha proposes, the Second Noble Truth states, is that letting go of wanting is the path to happiness, rather than trying to have more and more things being the path to happiness. So if we have some sense of this view of the First Noble Truth being something that we're curious or interested in exploring, then we can look at how that view might shape our intentions. What would we want to do differently in our lives? How would we want to behave? How do we want to act? With what intention do we wish to step into the world? If we think about each of these aspects of Wise View, we think about the aspect of karma, that acting out of greed, aversion, and delusion brings us more and more entrenched into suffering. Acting out of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion begins to release us, to free us from suffering. Then we would come to the intention of behaving skillfully, of cultivating wholesome states of mind and letting go as much as possible of unwholesome, unskillful states of mind. Looking at the view of the Four Noble Truths, when we look at this with respect to ourselves, seeing that, or understanding that, maybe not seeing just yet, but with a little bit of the understanding that perhaps the wanting that underlies a lot of our motivation is actually a source of our suffering, then this would incline us towards letting go of this craving, this wanting. And if we see that it's not only us that are subject to these truths, that everyone is subject to suffering, and that everyone is in this same boat of really trying to be happy, trying to find a way towards happiness, and just misunderstanding how to get there. And in experiencing that connection with others, and understanding that we're all kind of in the same boat, it brings an intention towards compassion and kindness. So the wise intention of the Eightfold Path has three main intentions that are suggested. They're the intention towards renunciation, particularly around wanting things of the material world. There's the intention towards kindness and the intention towards compassion. Harmlessness, also it's said, the intention towards harmlessness. Before the Buddha became awakened, he was exploring the ways his thoughts worked. And at one point he decided that in seeing his thoughts, he found that some thoughts seemed to be helpful and some thoughts seemed to be unhelpful. And so he decided to kind of split his thoughts into two categories. He said, what if I put thoughts of sense desire, ill will, and cruelty on one side, and thoughts of renunciation, non-ill will, and non-cruelty on the other side. He saw that the thoughts of sense desire, ill will, and cruelty tended to lead him into suffering. That he saw that they caused harm for himself, for others, for both. But the thoughts of renunciation, of letting go of sense desire, thoughts of non-ill will and non-cruelty, or thoughts of kindness and compassion, he said, I saw that even if I thought and pondered on those for a day or a night and a day, I had nothing to fear from them. So he saw that these thoughts didn't need to be abandoned. He said, what I needed to do was to be mindful of them, to be aware that they were present. But I didn't need to worry about them so much. So this division is essentially the division of wise intention versus unwise intention. So I'd like to go through each of these intentions and explore them a little bit with you. So the first, the intention of renunciation. Renunciation has a bad rap. We don't like the word. We don't like the ideas it conjures up. But really what renunciation is about, I looked up the word to see if I could, you know, find a better word. Relinquishment came up. I thought that was a nicer word. Letting go. But in looking at the actual definition of the word renunciation, it seemed appropriate because the renunciation has a little bit of force to it. And it takes a little bit of mental inclination to cut through this wanting. Because wanting that goes with sense desire has such a grip on us. Why does this have such a grip on us? And the main reason it has such a strong hold on us is because we believe, very deeply believe, that our happiness is bound up in getting the things that we want. And because of that belief, while that belief is operating, it's really hard to let go of the wanting. Because we think our happiness relies on that wanting. So the Buddha, seeing this, realized that, you know, it's not so easy to let go of this wanting for sense desire. So this renunciation, the renunciation that we're talking about here, isn't a kind of forceful repression, as the word renunciation might imply to us. But it is a forceful meeting. It is a forceful recognizing of this wanting and being willing to watch that process of wanting. So if we watch this process around sense desire, if we reflect on what sense desire is, we see that it is the aspect of pleasantness in our sense experience and the wanting of that pleasure. So the pleasant experience comes to our five sense doors. We see pleasant things, we hear pleasant things, taste pleasant things, and we want that. There's a kind of a happiness that comes when we experience pleasant senses, and we want more of it. But if we look at this process of the wanting itself, the sense desire, the desire part of the sense desire, if we look at that, what we see is that as soon as that wanting begins, there's a feeling of lack. There's a feeling that something's missing. There's a feeling that something's wrong. So this sense desire inherently comes with a feeling that there's something missing, a feeling of dissatisfaction, a feeling of unease, a feeling of dukkha. This term dukkha, the Pali term usually translated as suffering. Now, when we experience wanting, we don't normally think of it as suffering. In fact, when we think of something we want, we often find it to be a pleasant thing, partly because what's going on is that we're anticipating. We're expecting, perhaps, to get something pleasant, and that anticipation has a pleasant, the fantasy of the anticipation has a pleasant quality to it. So that anticipation kind of masks the suffering of the wanting. So we have this wanting, this immediate kind of wanting that's connected, bound up with this aspect of dukkha, of suffering. And then, if we don't get the thing that we want, we suffer even more because we feel like we've failed, we've done something wrong. Why didn't I get that thing? Why did that person get that thing instead of me? So we suffer from that. If we get the thing, we do get a moment of happiness. We get a moment where we think, yeah, okay, things are good now. But then pretty much immediately following that, there's a sense of, how can I keep this? How can I hold on to it? What's going to happen if somebody comes along and tries to take it away from me? And so we hold on to it with a fear that it will go away. So there's that gripping that comes, that a little anxiety that comes around having the things that we want. And if we lose it, which is almost inevitable, or is inevitable, if you think of death being the losing of anything that we have accumulated, when we lose it, we have a sense again of something's wrong. This is not the way it's supposed to be. We feel sad. We feel depressed. So it's hard for us to fathom a happiness apart from sense desire and sense pleasure, because for so long, that's the main happiness that we've known. A state of happiness apart from sense desire is unfamiliar to most of us until we begin. Well, it may not be completely unfamiliar to us. I mean, many of us have had moments in our past and in childhood when you just, you know, had this sense of waking up and hearing the sound of a mourning dove, you know, happiness, not, you know, the sense not of holding on to that, but just of being present and seeing the sense of being here. And that kind of happiness isn't so much about trying to hold on to things or grasp on things, but is a kind of a happiness that comes with letting go and opening to what is here. And that's what we really cultivate in our meditation practice. And we get more and more tastes of that kind of happiness as we engage in our practice. So we can begin in our meditation practice to fathom a happiness apart from sense desire. And yet the habit of sense pleasure and wanting to have things nice around us, to arrange our lives so that we have the things we want and get rid of the things we don't want, that habit is very strong. So it's hard to let go of this habit, and the Buddha recognized that it's not really possible to let it go through an act of will. We can't simply say, I'm not going to do that anymore, because we've been doing it for so long. If we tried to do that, it might lead to a repression, to a sense of, oh, I'm not going to act on that sense desire. I'm just going to cut those things out of my life. And that is acting on a different kind of unwholesome desire, that of aversion. So the Buddha suggests that the way to cut through the attachment to sense pleasure, to the habit around sense desire, has to do with understanding and wisdom. That when we understand that this wanting is bound up with suffering, we begin to recognize it's helpful to let it go. And with that reorientation, it loses its grip a little bit. So the Buddha actually, I think he had a brilliant suggestion here in terms of looking at this. You might call it the problem of wanting, the problem of sense desire. He said, well, let's not try to get rid of it. Let's look at and try to understand what we like about it. Let's look at how it feels gratifying to us. So he suggests starting there in terms of understanding this sense desire. So there is a gratification to sense pleasure. There's no doubt about it. When pleasant things hit our senses, it feels good, we like it, it creates a kind of a happiness and joy. There is a happiness and joy that is associated with sense pleasure. So there's no need to deny that. No need to try to stop that process from happening. In fact, we can't stop that process from happening. When pleasant sense contact happens, pleasure happens in the body, often responding by pleasure in the mind. But we don't simply leave it as that. What happens to us? What is this gratification with respect to sense pleasure? So the Buddha asks us to look at this. How does this gratification actually come to be? How long does it last? And what happens when it ends? So, looking at this process in terms of when we actually meet this sense of gratification, we actually see that the moments of sense pleasure themselves are pretty small. We tend to, when we get something we like it, we clearly like it for a moment. And then along with that comes a lot of thoughts of, oh, now I've got this thing that I like, and this means things about me, that I got this thing that I liked. I got this this job that is a great job that is allowing me to do all these great things. And this is a wonderful thing. This is not something to be dismissed. But we move from that kind of basic sense of the gratification of the experience itself into stories about me. I'm a good person. I can do this. And those become very sticky for us. We tie our sense of identity to the fact that we can arrange our lives to satisfy our sense pleasures. We feel like if we can do that, we're a good person. We can arrange our lives in this way, then we're okay. And if it falls apart, or when it falls apart, our identity is also threatened. So we feel like, oh, I'm not a good person. I must be a bad person. I must be a failure if I can't do this. So watching the process of this gratification, the satisfaction. Another area we start to see, another thing we start to see is the process of how this gratification comes to be. And let's take a simple example this time. The job was a little bit of a big example. Take a simple example of, getting some food that you like, having a chocolate craving, and then getting the chocolate. So if we look at this in its simplicity, we see that initially there's this sense of wanting, the craving, the kind of sense of a little bit of dissatisfaction around the wanting. And then when we get the chocolate, we're satisfied. You know, we have this sense of, oh, that's what I wanted, and I got it. So when we get that thing, we get this, the hit of sense pleasure around the having the thing that we wanted. And we also get the benefit of the fact that the wanting goes away. So we actually get a double hit of pleasantness when we get what we want. And in actuality, the disappearance of the wanting is the bigger pleasure. If you give yourself the opportunity to hang out with a wanting, a small wanting like this, play with this sometime when you notice that you have a craving for something. And watch that wanting. And see what happens when the wanting goes away. When the wanting disappears, the dissatisfaction disappears. So this gratification around sense pleasure, a large measure of the gratification we get has to do with the disappearance of the wanting. As I said, there is also the pleasure, the actual sense pleasure, but it's very brief and momentary. Think about how long the pleasure of the chocolate actually lasts. It's not very long. So we have a fundamental misunderstanding about how happiness is created. The getting what we want, we think the getting what we want is where it's at. So the Buddha recommends looking at this process of gratification of sense pleasure and see, what do you actually recognize? So, you know, he's not saying we have to jump over sense pleasure and try to cut it out of our lives, but he wants us to look at it, explore the nature of the desire in particular. Because as we explore this gratification, we begin to understand that the problem inherent in it, or it's not the sense pleasure itself, it's the wanting. And this is what the Buddha calls the danger with respect to sense pleasure. And this is the next aspect of this exploration around understanding sense pleasure, exploring the danger. The danger is fundamentally, the danger with respect to sense pleasure is connected with the wanting. It's not in the sense pleasure itself. The sense pleasures will happen. It's the needing to arrange the world to have what we want. So with this fundamental misperception around how happiness works, we simply live our lives on this wheel, this spinning wheel of trying to continually arrange our lives to stack up one happy thing after another and get rid of the unhappy things. We think that arranging things is what's going to do it for us. This fundamental misunderstanding, keeping us on this wheel, the danger of that is that it prevents us from actually searching for happiness where it's more reliably found, in letting go of the wanting. And that comes to the third aspect of this exploration around sense pleasure, understanding the escape from sense pleasure. And this has to do with letting go of that wanting. Not letting go of the sense pleasure. The sense pleasure will come and go. Sense unpleasure will come and go. It's just the natural course of life that pleasant things will happen, unpleasant things will happen, neutral things will happen. We can't really stop that process, but we can cut into the wanting things to be a certain way or wanting things to be some way other than they are. So this letting go of sense pleasure, as the Buddha recognized, this is not an easy task. And one thing that he recognized is that it's easier to let go of sense pleasure if there's some other kind of experience that's, in a sense, more pleasurable, more satisfying, maybe I could say, more satisfying. So that it's easy to let go of something that's less satisfying for something that's more satisfying. And he points to the pleasure of meditation, the pleasure of concentration, as being a stepping stone, moving away from the dependence. I mean, it's kind of like we're breaking an addiction to sense pleasure. So we need something that will allow us to take that step away from the addiction to sense pleasure. And so we can move into cultivating concentration, cultivating stillness of mind, stability of mind, letting go of the need to do things in the world in favor of just resting, coming back and recognizing that as the mind lets go of all of that busyness, it actually feels pretty good. Feels pretty good to hang out here and just let the mind get quiet. It actually starts to feel really good. And we begin to understand it as being a more wholesome kind of happiness than the happiness of the sense pleasure. So that's kind of the weaning process. We move from sense pleasure to kind of appreciating the qualities of happiness and joy that can come through the practice of meditation, of concentration. But we can get addicted to those too. We can end up caught in a cycle of just wanting states of mind, wanting to be in a state of bliss and peace. And that wanting then for those states also starts to get in the way. And at that point, the Buddha recommends the medicine of insight, the recognition of the impermanence, the unsatisfactoriness, and the not-self-nature of all things, including these states of in meditation, the happiness, the joy that comes up in meditation, are also constructed states that will fall apart. So we can't count on them either. So the pleasure of insight, of understanding, of not clinging to anything, the Buddha says this is the highest happiness. But no, that's probably not the next sitting or the next hour. So we need to work with all of this. We need to come back to the sense pleasure, look at how it feels, not try to push it away, acknowledge the fact that there is pleasure in it. Look at how far that pleasure actually extends. Where is the little itchiness to that pleasure? Is it really ultimately satisfying? And is being on this wheel, this cycle of having to keep getting what we want, really the way to go? So this intention towards renunciation, this letting go, can be seen as really the entire path of our practice. That more and more we just recognize what we're holding on to and see the suffering that comes with that holding. And as we see the suffering, it begins to release. Not out of an act of will, of forcing, but because we understand through the witnessing, through the mindful connection with experience, we understand the suffering. The first noble truth, we understand the suffering. And through that understanding, the mind begins to let go. We don't have to do it. It just begins to release. So the second intention that comes in wise intention is the intention of goodwill, or the intention of non-ill will. So this intention of goodwill opposes thoughts of ill will. Ill will being, in its more obvious forms, anger, aversion, hostility, contempt. In its milder flavors, irritation, annoyance, displeasure. In its mildest forms, even something just like dislike, not liking. Our usual way of responding to ill will is to kind of take one of two paths. We either kind of go with it, feel justified in, yeah, that person did that thing, you know, I'm mad at them. And so there's a sense of feeling justified about it. Or we try to repress it. Neither of these is terribly helpful. But we have seemed to believe or have come to the understanding that these are our only two choices. We either, you know, really feel it and get into it, or we try to repress it and stuff it. The Buddha suggests a middle ground between these two, which is not to repress it, not to deny the fact that this ill will, this anger, irritation, annoyance, frustration, that this ill will has arisen, but also not to buy into it, not to allow it to motivate our actions. Instead, to turn towards it with mindfulness. Can we just hang out with the fact that ill will has arisen? This is one way of cultivating an intention towards non-ill will. The ill will is present, and yet being held in the space of mindfulness, that mindfulness brings in a kind of a reorientation of the intention around the ill will. So that it's not, that ill will is not kind of like flowing out of us and creating actions. Instead, it's just being kind of observed. So the ill will has arisen. I talked about this on Monday night. The fact that things have arisen, you know, causes and conditions have led this ill will to arise. Things as they are, it's like this. So not to try to stop it. We can't really stop it. It's already there. But we can just watch that process unfold, that process of ill will appearing. And it has its life. All of these things are kind of like a wave. So we can kind of ride that wave. Just be mindful of the wave of ill will and watch it dissipate. Watch it flow out. And this is cultivating the intention towards non-ill will. And it's not always easy to do that. So the Buddha offers some other techniques to help us with reorienting our intention around ill will to move towards intention of kindness, intention of, essentially the intention of metta. He suggests, first of all, reflecting on the drawbacks of ill will. Looking at, what does it do to us? I mean, through this ill will, we have a negative mind state that's unpleasant. And also it can create a kind of a stress in the body, a physiological stress to be in a state of anger. So is it really worth it? Is it really worth it? Just contemplating the drawbacks towards yourself. And this ill will also potentially puts you in danger of harming someone, of lashing out, even at someone that we love. This is one of the tools the Buddha used himself, reflecting on the drawbacks of these negative thoughts. The other way, or another way to work with reorienting ourselves around this intention, is to actively cultivate the intention towards kindness, the intention towards metta. The quality of metta directly opposes ill will. Quality of metta being a feeling of well-wishing for others. A kindness, feeling of friendliness, of warmth, of connection with others. It doesn't come with a feeling of obligation. It's a more open quality that connects without that sense of obligation. And the Buddha said that this quality, when it's strengthened, can become a boundless, beautiful quality of love that pervades and is radiated out to all beings everywhere. So we can work with this intention, a purposeful cultivation of this quality of metta, to move towards this intention of goodwill. I'm going to read a quote here from Bhikkhu Bodhi around this idea of purposely cultivating the intention towards love, kindness. And love is sometimes another translation used for metta. Bhikkhu Bodhi says, "The idea of deliberately developing love has been criticized as contrived, mechanical, and calculated. Love, it is said, can only be genuine when it is spontaneous, arisen without inner prompting or effort. But it is a Buddhist thesis that the mind cannot be commanded to love spontaneously. It can only be shown the means to develop love and enjoined to practice accordingly." So that we can learn to love. As we practice, and the path towards cultivating this quality of love is very simple. In a formal way, in a formal practice, we simply bring to mind people, starting with ourselves and bringing to mind others, and then we begin expressing wishes of kindness towards them. May you be happy. May you be healthy. May you be safe. May you live with ease. This phrase is actually expressing the intention of kindness. The practice is about expressing that intention and then noticing how it lands in the mind and body. We may find that when we express that intention, we feel a sense of constriction, a contraction, a fear. There's not going to be enough love for me, not enough happiness for me. If I wish other people happiness, what about me? Or it might be a feeling of openness or connectedness. The practice is about seeing where you are in this moment with respect to this process of cultivating this intention. Over time, we start to see that as we feel this quality of love for ourselves, there's a kind of a natural radiating outward of it. As we feel happy and safe, and as we feel this sense of inner love, it naturally wants to be shared. We see it's not a zero-sum game. That the more love there is, that it's not that it's the pie that's divided, so that it generates. It's self-generating. So this movement towards the intention of metta becomes more natural as we engage in it deliberately. It may feel contrived initially, but it moves to being a very... We see that it's not contrived. And if we understand the practice as being one of expressing an intention and an inclining of the heart, not as something that I'm saying, well, I'm feeling love. That's not what it's working. It's not how it works. We don't try to delude ourselves or deceive ourselves that we're feeling love for people. We just express the wish and notice how we respond. And over time, that movement of repeating the thoughts, repeating, inclining the mind in that direction, begins to open our hearts to that connection. The third kind of intention is the intention towards harmlessness or compassion. And this is in opposition to cruel, aggressive thoughts. The intention towards harming is the wish that others be harmed in some way. And this wish actually, you know, we don't think of ourselves necessarily as being beings who wish others harm, but, you know, we all have that seed in us. I found this in my practice. In my first few years of practice, I was really exploring an anger that I had for this one particular person. And at one point, I saw in my mind arise this wish that something happened to him. You know, not that I wanted to harm him, but that something would happen to him. There was a wish that he would be harmed in some way. And I was actually shocked. I mean, it was kind of painful to recognize this, and it really opened my mind to the recognition that that seed, I mean, it was like watching in my own heart where war comes from. I opened to that recognition that I'm not above this, you know, that it was really quite a... eye-opening, heart-opening experience to recognize that. And in that recognition, there was a kind of a letting go in a way. I mean, it was a recognizing, yes, this is in me. You know, it can be hard to be mindful of thoughts of cruelty, of thoughts of aggression, because we are so judgmental about them. You know, it's like we think that we have to get rid of them, because if we're having these thoughts, then it means something about us. It means that we will go harm somebody, or it means that that we believe them in some way. So it can be hard to be mindful of these thoughts, because they can come with so much self-judgment, and they can be shocking. But actually taking in the fact that this kind of thought arises, to me, what it did is it was almost a recognition of compassion in this, oh, I see how suffering happens here. I see how war begins. So again, the Buddha recommends contemplating the drawbacks of thoughts of cruelty without self-judgment. I'm going to read to you, because I found this kind of an inspiring piece for me to take in, to recognize that the Buddha worked with this stuff too. Before he was enlightened, he says, "As I abided, ardent and resolute, diligent, a thought of cruelty arose in me." The Buddha worked with these. I found a happiness around recognizing that I wasn't alone. "I understood thus, this thought of cruelty has arisen in me." He didn't understand, "I should get rid of this thought of cruelty. This is horrible." He understood it has arisen. Then he reflected. Non-judgmentally, he reflected, "This leads to my own affliction, to the other's affliction, to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from nibbana. When I considered this leads to my own affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this leads to others' affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this leads to the affliction of both, it subsided in me." So he used this practice of reflecting on the drawbacks, actually consciously thinking, not strictly mindfulness here, but consciously thinking about the drawbacks of these thoughts. We can also cultivate compassion formally in a similar way that we cultivate metta, through this practice of opening to particular beings and expressing the wish of compassion towards them. It's said that the proximate cause for compassion to arise is to see helplessness in those overwhelmed by suffering. And if you have seen that, I mean, if you've seen someone who is suffering and helpless, you can get a sense of that quality of compassion arising. So it's said to be easiest to begin this practice by directing this movement of compassion, this intention of compassion towards somebody who is suffering, someone who you know that's suffering, and just expressing the wish to them, may you be free of this suffering. And as we move out to explore the practice of compassion with other beings, with beings that we don't know very well, with beings that aren't suffering in this moment, we bring in the reflection that we are all subject, every one of us in the human condition, we are subject to aging, sickness, death. We're subject to loss, despair, sorrow, grief. Just the nature of being a human being has this aspect. It forms a connection for us to recognize our common humanity and the common ways that we suffer. opening our hearts to this intention towards compassion. So the Buddha says, whatever one frequently thinks and ponders, that becomes the inclination of the mind. That's something to rest with. Whatever one frequently thinks and ponders, that becomes the inclination of the mind. If one frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of sense desire, one abandons thoughts of renunciation and cultivates thoughts of sense desire. If one frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of ill will, one abandons thoughts of non-ill will and cultivates thoughts of ill will. If one frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of cruelty, one abandons thoughts of non-cruelty and cultivates thoughts of cruelty. One teacher, Mark Coleman, has said that in our usual state of being, and what this teaching to me points to also, in our usual state of being, this being bound up with our craving, we are effectively renouncing freedom. That in our usual state of being, what we're doing moment to moment is renouncing freedom. Turning our mind toward the intention of renunciation, metta and compassion, puts ourselves in line with the intention of freedom, the intention of happiness, this great happiness that the Buddha talked about. So I've talked the whole hour, so we don't have time for questions this week. Thank you for your attention.